five bills from last meeting, the insurance meeting we had exclusively on the insurance bills. They're before us today, 279, 280, 281, 282, 283. Each one of them we had committee substitute prepared, and there were only concerns on one of them, none of which we've taken any action on. Is there any questions anyone wants to ask the division director, Mr. Walsh?
We haven't had time to look at any of them. Anybody else has? I don't know if anybody has anybody else in the committee had time to read them. Maybe they can help me out understanding.
Well, they it'd take more than a few sentences. We had a special meeting that was just on these, and my conclusion from it all is that, with one exception, they're basically not controversial. They're a good idea. My inclination is to send them all to the Judiciary Committee. Whoever chairs that committee suffered through them.
Well, that's the problem with always getting these things at the end of the sessions, you know. I mean, we're really busy doing other things now. And
I don't believe that we're going to enact these into law this year, is my impression. And these are 279, 281, 282, 283. And I'd certainly try to participate in getting the hearings on yourself over the interim. I'm happy myself. We've got attendance Representative Ruckman, Representative Donner, Representative Finkelstein, Representative Ivan, Representative Sawacki.
Where are chairs made for total now?
Eddie, you survived with me through these five bills, the hearing we had the other evening. Any last minute questions you want to ask Mr. Walsh on this?
I can't really. I would move to pass them on a committee with individual.
The first motion on each one of them is a move to adopt the CS. We did have a CS for each one of them.
Oh, we haven't done that.
No.
That's right.
We didn't have it before. Representative Zwacky moves to adopt the committee substitutes for each of the previously named five bills. Is there objection? Hearing none, so adopted. Is there a motion on the bills themselves?
I would move to pass them on to individual
members. Let's do them one at a time, just to in case anyone differs. Vote for motions is to move to introduce recommendations. House Bill 279, is there objection? Hearing none, so adopted. Second one is House Bill 280. Same motion, is there objection? Hearing none, so moved. House Bill 281, same motion, is there objection? Hearing none, so moved. House Bill 282, same motion, is there objection? Hearing none, so moved. House Bill 283, same motion, is there objection? Hearing none, so moved. The next matter we're hoping to take up with the confirmation hearing is the commissioner in the vicinity. Let's go to House Bill 89 then, and start there. We will get as far as we can. We're going to have a real problem this week. Everyone can tell from the schedule, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, to get through what we're trying to get through. And I think what we'll have to do is, when we bog down, in order to kill everything else on the agenda for that day, to try to move relatively quickly through them. On House Bill 89, we gotta find the sponsor. Oh, there's no sponsor. It's by the Transportation Committee. I wonder. Do we have anyone from the department here?
Yes, there are.
Oh, great. If you could join us and offer any thoughts you have on House Bill 89, that'd be good. I'll note for record been joined by Representative Parnell as well.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jeff Otteson, Division Director of Engineering Operations Standards for the Department of Transportation. House Bill 89 has come a long way, not only this year, but in years past. I believe now we're at a point where the department and the unions are in agreement on an approach. You read our position paper. We're certainly not, strong advocates for it, but we are neutral toward it. It is workable. Try to find a way to make it fit everyone's needs.
Great. Well, I really commend you on your efforts on that.
Okay.
Any questions for any committee members?
Don Rulo. I'm with the District Council of Laborers. And I want to thank the Transportation Committee for sponsoring this bill. And I also like to thank DOT on their remarks there. This has been ongoing negotiations for approximately three and a half years, including this administration. And the bill that DOT is in is delivered, we can deal with it. And also AGC, there's no opposition from AGC. To give you a little background, possibly in the middle 80s, camps were a common thing amongst all Alaska contractors, union and non-union. In fact, we had it under our collective bargaining unit. But about that time, some outside firms, including the Canadian firm that was the first to notice that there was no law covering camps, so they had their people living in the makeshift shelters and that. And so over the next year or two, the contractors, the Alaska contractors, were losing their bid because they didn't. They were still including their camps in their contracts. The outside contractors weren't, so they had a big advantage when it comes to bids. So labor did give it up, and the other responsible contractors in Alaska had to give it up also. So the situation's been around 5 or 6 years with no camps. Last year, the DOT did promulgate some regulations that in remote areas that there would have to be at least camp facilities, sewer and water. And we applaud them for that, but it still didn't go far enough because it didn't take care of the workers that if they didn't have a camper, they'd be in makeshift lean-tos or tents or backseat of their cars or trucks. And so that's why we're sitting here today with this legislation. The unhealthy conditions are still out there, and the only way they can be alleviated is with adequate housing and food. And this one bill, there's been questions on what does it do to local hire. It certainly encourages local hire. From now on, when you have a bid, and they have to include a camp in there, although they're not required to have a camp, there's other options. They can get the low bid by hiring locally. So they either cut down on the size of the facility or remove it, period. So there is a great incentive for the contractors here to hire locally. And we certainly want to encourage you to move this out. It's a bill that just gives adequate living conditions, and it's not no built hotel out there, just basics. And we would ask your to be expedient in it, as if it doesn't pass this year, it won't go into effect till 93. If it passes this year, it'll go into effect. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Don. Any questions anyone has? Okay, appreciate your time today. We have one person on teleconference, representing by.
Has the community been adopted yet? Or?
No, we haven't done anything yet. On House Bill 89.
If it's not adopted, then I certainly would like to move to that effect.
Is there
transportation. Yeah, the only one we've got so far is the one that came over for transportation. We don't have yet one for our committee. So, let's go to Ron Jordan in Anchorage. Ron, if you could offer any brief remarks on the bill, we'd appreciate it.
Yes, my name is Ron Jordan in Anchorage, and I'm
here
to support this bill. I think it would remove a lot of problems in helping Alaska here in the past.
Okay, we appreciate your taking the time to join us today. You're welcome to stay and listen to the rest of the meeting. We don't have anyone else signed up for the bill to testify. Is there any committee discussion on the bill? I know Representative Donnelly has seen this bill quite a bit before, having worked on it extensively last year.
Also worked on it with the Transportation Committee. Mr. Chairman went to the hearings there.
The bill has been moved to individual recommendations. Is there further discussion on the bill? Is there objection to moving the bill to individual recommendations? Okay, hearing none, so moved. Next bill we've got up is Senate Bill 64, HFC. Joan, if you could join us and testify, we appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joan Hope. I'm the was added on as a floor amendment when the bill was on the Senate floor. They're not really related, so I'll address them almost separately. Section 3 is the substance of the bill that Senator Fahrenkamp introduced. What it does is define the term sponsor. Sponsor is a term referred to throughout HFC statutes, but it's nowhere defined in statute or in regulation. This bill defines sponsor to include nonprofit housing agencies, the consumer housing cooperative, a lot of kind of non-traditional types of entities that might want to build multifamily low-income housing if HFC should ever choose to start making loans for that purpose. This could be done by regulation, but it was our feeling that it would be better because administrations change and personnel comes and goes. It would be better for the legislature to do this and to make this quite broad so as not to exclude things like, for example, here in Juneau, a group, an offshoot of the Cooperative Church Council is looking to become a to get nonprofit status to build low-income housing. We want to encourage that kind of thing. The other sections 1, 2, 4, and 5, are an amendment that was proposed by Senator Rohde on the Senate floor. Last year, a bill passed, House Bill 368, which was sponsored by Representative Swackhammer, that required that homes that are financed with public funds, like AHFC loans, would have to be inspected. They would have to meet certain building standards that would have to be inspected in order to qualify for AHFC loans. There was a 1991 effective date put into that legislation. However, they're having a hard time finding people to train to be certified and qualified building inspectors. There are only 5 of them in the state right now. And they all work for municipalities. So to give AHFC a little extra time to get people trained to do this certification and inspection, this would extend the effective date of that for 1 year, just to allow a little extra time. I'd be happy to answer any questions on either part of the bill.
Great. Representative Donovan, so is that a proposed amendment that we would have to add to that?
No, it was done on the Senate floor, sir.
I would pass one.
So, you're speaking in favor of CS for Senate Bill number 6450.
Amended,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't have any questions myself. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think Max Giffers here for Senator Rohde as well, if we have any questions on the other angle of it. Well, Joan, if you could join us again. Just tell us again the importance of defining sponsors. We should let me know, too, where Joy represents Taylor.
The term sponsor is used different places in the statutes. An example I gave in your memo is one of HFC statutes says that the corporation may, for the purpose of providing housing for persons of lower and moderate income or persons located in remote, underdeveloped, or blighted areas of the state, and for its other corporate purposes, make or participate in the making of mortgage loans to sponsors, developers, builders, and purchasers of residential housing. That term could, if we interpret it broadly, could allow for a lot of maybe non-conventional, non-developer type entities to enter the low-income housing market. For example, the example I gave, the Cooperative Church Council or a consumer housing cooperative. We would just like to ensure that entities like that, as long as they're fiscally responsible, would not be precluded from getting AHFC loans to develop more low-income multifamily housing should AHFC choose to branch out into that. They have the statutory authority, but they never have done that. AHFC has said that they could do this by regulation, but they never have, and this has been on the books for 20 years. We would just like to ensure that the legislature makes that definition rather than an agency, and to define it broadly but fairly liberally but sort of precisely at the same time.
Yeah. Thank you, Joan. Anyone have any questions on the other angle of the bill, the 1 year delay? If anyone wants to ask any questions on that. Questions. Do we have anyone else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 64?
do. I guess I'm confused because if we're defining sponsor for the first time, but it's never been defined by regulation, and they're not doing this now, then why did we delay it a year?
If that's not related, the definition of sponsor is all that the bill that Senator Faircamp introduced addressed. However, when Senator Rohde was contacted, when it was realized that this other bill that Representative Swackhammer had sponsored last year had an effective date that was not going to be possible to meet, they added a big amendment to extend all of that.
It's on a non-related issue.
Yeah, completely unrelated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jeff. I just didn't understand what it had to do with it. Any further questions or committee discussion?
I would move to pass it out to the committee.
Is there a discussion?
Jack, briefly, I did have a question. We were trying to get caught up since it came in late.
They were cranking. So.
I understand.
You're welcome to this. So. Hold it over to the end of this meeting or to the beginning of next meeting.
No, I don't want to do that. I only wanted to clarify for myself what the security, what we were doing to security, if we in fact would allow cooperative church councils, which are nonprofits, or other non-governmental agencies to qualify for AHFC loans to provide low-income housing should they choose to either make them a sponsor or a recipient. Are we mandating AHFC reduce the level of security that it would normally reach to?
No. In fact, through the chair, I've talked to AHFC about this a lot. If they were to, for example, sell a bond package to build multifamily low-income housing, I went to a bond financing seminar in Anchorage in March to find out how that would work. And when you have a smaller pool, for example, you might sell a smaller bond with only, say, four developers really being responsible for the money that would be involved in doing multifamily housing. Those developers or sponsors would actually be held to a higher test, a higher financial commitment than you or I would be on a home loan, because our risk is spread out through so many other borrowers. And in the case of this, if they were to sell bonds for multifamily housing, their risk wouldn't be spread as broadly. So as a result, you have to come up with a lot more cash up front, land, you know, a lot more, a bigger down payment, so to speak. So no, this wouldn't lower the test at all. It would just say that if they otherwise qualify, they shouldn't be precluded from getting a loan just because they're not your normal developer kind of an outfit. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me that opportunity. I withdraw my objection.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Taylor. Thank you. So, is there further objection to pass the bill out with individual recommendations? If not, so done. Before we go to the confirmation hearing, we do have one last bill. Mr. Walsh could join us, if it turns out to be a relatively fast matter, we can do that. If there's committee interest in pursuing it more, we'll hold it over until we get to the confirmation hearing. Mr. Walsh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is on Senate Bill 251. Senate Bill 251 is a very small bill having to do with exercising the state's right to opt out of federal regulation of insurance. In the early 80s, Congress and the Reagan administration passed a number of bills designed to jumpstart the economy. They indeed did that, and they gave us the junk bond market, the savings and loan crisis, and this bill is part and parcel of it. What the bill does is it says that the states may not regulate the amount of money an insurance company invests in the non-government guaranteed secondary mortgage market. In other words, despite the fact that the solvency statutes that the legislature passed last year limit any one investment to 5% of the insurance company, of any given insurance company's total, they could put 100% in, we could do nothing about it. In my view, this is the junk bonds of the 90s. high yield, relatively low risk as long as they don't, as the market doesn't get out of hand. But it would, if this bill does not pass this session, it will slash a huge hole in our solvency regulations. What Congress provided in 1984 when they passed this bill is that the states had 7 years to opt out. That 7 years expires in October of this year. So this is a must-pass bill for us this session. I cannot tell the committee why the division did not discover this before about April 1 of this year. It's because it's been around for 6 years. But I can say that once we did discover it, we had a bill drafted and put in, and it passed the Senate on a 17-0 vote. My understanding is that there's a committee substitute here which would further elaborate the language to make it clear what sections of Alaska statutes we are relying on to regulate these types of securities. After talking with the legislative drafter, we have no objection to this amendment, and we would urge the adoption of the committee substitute and request that the committee pass it out today if possible so that it can go to the other committee of referral and into the floor.
Hey, Mr. Walsh, I'll let you know for everyone that you do have the committee substitute, a House CS dated May 7th, and it is purely technical. And the committee substitute, no change in substance.
There is, Mr. Chairman, I believe, a packet of information which we provided to the committee, and I'm sure it was copied for everyone.
Are there any questions for Mr. Walsh?
Yes, my understanding, Mr. Waltz, each of these bills, there's quite a whole packet of them here on regulations being established for reinsurers and for managers and other definitions. But each of those go from here to judiciary and judiciary to finance.
They don't go to finance. They just go to judiciary. The five-bill package, which was taken earlier, and this bill as well, these have no fiscal impact. So there was not a finance referral.
Yeah, okay. I had a concept, but I haven't been able to find my bill. There it is. Very bottom. I wanted to address with you, but it may not be related here.
Is it, if it's... You know, if it's not on 251, what we ought to do is bring it up after the confirmation hearing.
Yeah, I just wanted to. This is a cleanup that we and I talked about.
Right. Off,
yes, sir. My question wouldn't be on this, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Yeah, we did a. Once we get to the confirmation hearing, you can stay. Have any chance to stay around or talk to Mr. Taylor outside the meeting at those workers as well. Is there a motion to adopt the CS? Representative Bruckman, so moves. Is there objection to adopt the CS? Hearing none, it's adopted. Is there any other discussion on the House CS for Senate Bill 251, Representative Donnelly?
Yeah, I'm just curious. There's a lot of these bills are being introduced this year, but none of them are governor's bills. Seems like in the past the governor would introduce these situations necessary through the Rules Committee, but they're being introduced by different Labor and Commerce committees, and I'm wondering if, and they're being really late in the session also. Wonder what's going on this year with that.
Well, I can't speak for the administration in general. From the division's point of view, we requested 7 bills to be introduced, but the 5-bill package, the MICA bill, and this bill. This bill is in a category by itself because until slightly more than a month ago, we didn't even realize this problem existed. The MICA bill was introduced, I think, around the 1st of March, because after the sale was concluded, my staff worked with the legislative drafter to come up with the appropriate language. Similarly, with the 5-bill package, these are NAIC, National Association of Insurance Commissioners models that we did not receive word from the NAIC that we needed these for certification until February 15th. And then at that point, we started to work on them and had them introduced. The 5-bill package is certainly not key for passage this year. We believe the other two are. When it came time for these to be introduced, I checked with the legislative liaison for the governor, and it was his advice that we have the various labor and commerce committees introduce them. I don't know what went into that decision. I don't know whether that's going to become a modus operandi for the administration. just did, but obviously.
Okay. Thank you. Representative
Taylor. I think it is an interesting question that Representative Donnelly has raised, and it's my understanding that this administration had indicated early on that it intended to work with members of the legislature as opposed to merely filing bills on its own. And that's why we have Representative Moyer's bill on the shooting the rockets up at Fairbanks. You know, it was basically an administration bill, and they have gone around and basically handed out bills to various people, in particular in the majority, to work with them. So at least that was, a desire up front, which kind of surprised me.
So the motion is still before us to move the bill to individual recommendations. Further discussion on Senate Bill 251. Is there objection to moving to individual recommendations? Hearing none, so moved.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. Commissioner, if you could join us. My apologies for all the delays we've had. We've had a bit of a zoo on the floor, and I feel rather badly how it turned out, but I promise you we'll launch a complete thing today. So we got quite a ways with our confirmation hearing before. I think there was a couple. Do you recall any matters where you're going to bring anything back to the committee? My memory sort of faded since it's been so long.
My recollection is that we have provided the committee with most of the information that was requested. We responded to several inquiries, and I believe that Representative Buckman and Representative Ivan had asked for some feeling from a policy standpoint of where we started a couple of issues, and we could respond to that. I'd be happy to elaborate on that.
I'm not sure I've even got it. Where did everyone have it? If you want to offer an elaboration, that'd be great. I'm not sure if members have had a chance to look at it yet. So, you're also welcome to make any other comments before members ask questions.
Well, I think we've gone through the preliminaries, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Okay. Questions for committee members either on the memos or any other matters, of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, one of the things that was the follow-up the commissioner provided us with was a position on Little Davis Bay Dam, and I guess it's in the members' packets. I just wanted to do a follow-up question on that. One of the keys to Little Davis Bay Dam is how it's calculated. If currently the way it's been calculated, is, I think the last 8 years, is that when new contracts are adopted, benchmark contracts by the AGC, general contractors with the local unions, that's been rolled into the base rate of Little Davis Bacon as an automatic function that the Department of Labor performs in calculating it. I was wondering if the Department of Labor is going to continue that practice or just going to change that practice?
That practice is ordinarily conducted on an interim basis between surveys where the union wage, for example, has prevailed in the survey. If there is a change in negotiations or a change in the rate that's paid, and that union during the last survey prevailed, the interim change is made. And I'll give you a specific example, especially for the benefit of those who may not be as familiar with it as you, Representative Donald. Is that recently there was a negotiation with the Bricklayers Union where the rate, the negotiation resulted in a $1.42 reduction in wages, with that amount being transferred over into an equal amount in benefits. The bottom line was that the rate doesn't change, the overall rate doesn't change, but in terms of the way the wages are computed, it reduced the salary structure by $1.42. As a practical matter, that union prevailed in the wages. In the last survey, that is, that union represented more than 50% of the workers conducting work in that area. Consequently, we received a request from them to prevail that negotiated wage, and we've granted that request on an interim basis. Now, we are planning to conduct a survey this fall for the 19. We'll be conducting the survey for the 91 construction season and have a new wage survey available as well.
Okay, well.
Does that respond to your question? In other words, yes, the current practice, if the union wage is a prevailing wage, if there is more than a majority of the workers represented by that union group in the marketplace, and they negotiate a change in their wage scale, that will be factored into the prevailing wage survey on an interim basis.
Okay. Yeah, that's
that
helpful? Other questions from committee members?
No, but I would like to point out that in the past, all they collected from for a considerable period of time were union contracts that met certain standards that they then accepted as prevailing wages. All non-union contracts and work done in the same field and area were disregarded. That led to such abuses that we had to have Representative Sun go in to see the governor, Cooper, at the time, to then talk to the commissioner of labor, or else we would have lost major work in my district, primarily because the unions had forced the prevailing thing so high that no one could get on the work down there. I certainly hope you're not going to allow that to happen again in the future, because had it not been for us being able to pull some strings in the governor's office and distort the process probably as badly as it had been distorted the other way, the whole area would have lost the work. So I think this is a refreshing change to find out that we're actually going to take surveys of all people working in a given field.
Other questions? In the area of workers' compensation, I wrote Commissioner a while back about some of the issues in that area that have developed. As you're familiar with, last summer there was a decision by the board that they would not forward notices of frivolous controversies to the Division of Insurance as the statutes require. They made a real strained decision, which clearly was against the intent of the statute, that no notice would be required to the Division of Insurance unless the board had in fact ordered the insurer to pay, and then the insurer still didn't pay. And I had asked you in your capacity to examine that and see if you would seek support to repeal that decision on the part of the board. Have you looked at that matter? Have you taken a position on that?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stanley, I'm vaguely familiar with it. I believe that one of the true values of having a workers' compensation board comprised as it is that they're not attorneys, with all due respect. They look at these, and as a matter of fairness, they serve as jury in determining it. We present them with the law, and they have the same prerogative of interpretation as the courts would under the Administrative Procedures Act. I don't believe it would be appropriate for me to instruct those board members as to how to interpret those laws any more than I think it would be appropriate for me to suggest to a jury how they should find a particular case in front of them. As I say, I'm certainly not intimate with the law. I have read some of the memoranda on it. I think that when the board has a case come before it that brings a similar fact pattern for reevaluation, we'll see how they rule, just like the judges and the courts do on these matters.
Commissioner, as the chair of the Workers' Comp Board, you or your designee sits in on the hearings and actually gets to vote one way or the other, right?
Yeah.
So I guess I'm asking you, as your opinion, as the chair, a voting member of that board, would you vote to reverse that decision at this time?
I don't know, Mr. Jones Connelly. I can't respond to that because I don't know what the facts of the case put before me would be. And I think that, again, I'm sitting as a layperson on that board. There are two other people who participate in those deliberations, and we have to take the fact pattern of the case that's put before us and interpret it on a case-by-case basis.
Well, I don't believe that's true, because this is an interpretation of the law. It's not an interpretation of the facts. So I'm going to ask you a question based on the law. Since the law says notice should be provided to the Division of Insurance by the board when an employer is found to have frivolously controverted a claim, do you think that requires that the board first find, order the employer to pay, and then, and only if then, the employer still refuses to pay, that's the only time that notice would be provided? That's one. Or do you think it's two,
that if the board finds they frivolously denied a claim, they go ahead and notify the Division of Insurance that that's happened. Which one of those two things do you think it means, or do you think it means something else?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Donnelly, I would suggest that if you'd like to present with me a fact pattern, I would be more than happy to have my counsel rule on what they believe the interpretation of that law would be. My capacity in sitting on the Workers' Compensation Board is to review the cases on a case-by-case basis and do that. I see the legislature's role certainly is in making those laws, and my job is to enforce them, and the judiciary branch's role is to interpret them.
Well, Commissioner, I think you have a serious misunderstanding of the function of a quasi-judicial board then, because you do sit as both a trier of fact and a trier, finder of the law.
Mm-hmm.
My question is not based on fact. My question is based on interpretation of the law the way it is now. You don't need to know any facts to do that. Courts consistently in their judicial role, as the board does, can make findings of law that are unrelated to the findings, their capacity as a trier of fact. Now, I'm asking you, in your position as trier of fact, you don't need to know any facts to assess what that law means. And that's what my question is. And I've written you about this. You've been on notice of this for a couple months now, I think, this particular issue. And I'd really like to know what your position is going to be as to what that law means.
See if she has a response. I'll go to you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Donnelly, very quickly, my response is I thank you for the education on my role with regard to the Workers' Compensation Board. And as I've already mentioned, I'm vaguely familiar with this. I certainly don't recall any communication from you dealing specifically with this issue. I recall receiving a memorandum on a very broad range of issues that you offered to indicated your interest in within the department. I'm not inclined to give perfunctory and spontaneous answers on things that obviously require a great deal of thought. And, upon reflection and review and looking at the facts and looking at the law and looking at the circumstances, I would be happy to respond, but I think it would be inappropriate for me to try to spontaneously give you an answer.
Yeah, that's a fair answer.
I don't wish to interrupt line of inquiry, because I think it's very fine. It seemed to me that both parties are, in essence, saying the same thing, unless I'm missing the boat here. As a member of the board, they have to find frivolous first. Once they found frivolous, then they need to notify. Because the previous board never found frivolous until an insurance company had failed to pay before they would refer it, I can't imagine that is a precedent-setting thing that would bind the future board or this commissioner, and obviously you would not want the commissioner bound by that kind of a precedent-setting thing. And maybe I misheard him. It sounded to me like you were saying, if the facts indicate frivolous, we're going to report. But if they don't indicate frivolous, I'm not going to report. Without some facts, I can't tell. And that would seem to be the point you're trying to achieve. Now, unless I'm missing it completely, if I am, forgive me for
that. That's logical, but I think it misses the tone that was put on it. What the law says is, and what we wanted to do was to assess and make sure we had evidence that there were a lot of frivolous controversies in workers' compensation. We had testimony in this committee that certain insurers, as a regular course of business, controverted every claim.
Yeah, right.
That was against public policy, we felt, and so we sought to put into the law a deterrent to that by saying when it's shown that they're frivolously converting every claim, no matter what the merits of the claim were, that the Division of Insurance would be notified by the comp board of these frivolous controversies. That's putting the division on notice that there's some bad faith claims practice going on here, and they should examine these companies or talk to them about it. That seemed like a real reasonable request. But at a hearing this summer, an insurance company made the argument, not an insurance company, but the argument was made to the board in one of its three panel findings, and it wasn't based on fact, it was based on law, an interpretation of the law, that what that law meant was that the board would only notify the Division of Insurance if the board had ordered a insurance company to go ahead and pay, even though the insurance company refused to pay, the board ordered them to pay, and then they don't pay, then they would notify the Division of Insurance, not when they found that they had just simply refused to pay, or as a policy refusing to pay, or as a frivolous manner had refused to pay. So, accordingly, the statute has been rendered meaningless, because the insurance companies are always going to pay when they're ordered to pay, right?
That was by the old Cooper board.
Well, it was a bad decision by the board. It stunk. It was a lousy, lousy decision, and it was not done in a fair environment, as the commissioner referred to as a matter of fairness. In fact, it was a very prejudicial, biased environment because there was no representative.
Plus white males to go around, and we have to look at diversification in the workplace, and that's going to be reaching out to women, to minorities, to people all over the state, to seniors, to youth, to veterans, to the disabled, and see if we can't pull them into the mainstream of sustaining the economy. So I think that there are things that we can do to promote that type of activity and market it. So I see that all of that can tie into the rural initiative. We're working with the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, and certainly the governor has some plans in his rural initiative packages that we want to be involved in those discussions. Does that help?
One more follow-up. I know you're the enforcer of various laws that protect employees, but certainly all we're looking for is mostly technical assistance out there. Provide that to small businesses that are trying to start up a system to comply with regulations and laws. And certainly I would like to see some of your folks out in the district that I represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have 19 offices throughout the state. And we're looking, as a matter of fact, it came from a meeting today that we're talking about using that as a resource, as sort of a state resource center for all of the areas that are involved with the Department of Labor. It is difficult for people, particularly in the outlying areas, to get all the information they need. I'm a small businessman. I come up, I say, you know, I want to start this business, and I know that I've got to do something for the Department of Labor, but gosh, where do I go to get all the bits and pieces? We're trying to view the Department of Labor, and I think that we're getting there a day at a time, as a true service organization. We have a very clear constituency, and whether we can be physically present in every district, probably it's not cost-effective, but we certainly want to be as responsive as we can, whether it's by a single phone call or whether it's by walking into an employment service office, or hopefully I would like to extend the service center approach to all of state government. I think that we have a role to play in having a representative in every district, having a state service center concept. So I certainly note your concern, and we hope we can provide that support to your constituents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, Commissioner, one of the things I just maybe want to pass along to, which I have seen and heard, one of the concerns that I've had over the years was, and I think a lot of us, is the departments molding together and realizing they're all intertwined. You know, what they do could affect another department, and what they do could affect another part of the state in regards to some of their administrative regulations and changes in that. I've talked several times with Commissioner of Economic, Glenn Owens. I got to give him the call, Commissioner, but Glenn Owens and Commerce and Economic Community Regional Affairs, Avery Blatchford, and what I'm hearing and what I'm seeing is every time I have discussions with these people and talk about a certain issue or concern, they immediately start jumping in and saying, I've talked with you, or talked with Labor Department personnel, or I've talked with Commerce and Economic, and it's something that's long been missing. You know, it's refreshing to hear these commissioners saying that their people or they have been going to another department to get some information or get some assistance out there, and I hope that will continue to grow because it's long overdue. And I just want to pass along that I've been getting a lot of comments around the state, and not only through my constituents around that. It seems like there seems to be more openness by the departments, including yours, that people are willing to sit down and work with versus sit down and try to dictate to. That's the only thing that I've had concerns for years, and I hope to continue to see that type of attitude continue on, and I look forward to your confirmation. Thank you. Next.
wasn't even going to ask you what kind of cross-pollination are you encouraging and doing right now between your department and the other departments?
Between my department and the other departments? Well, I'm pleased to say that we are successfully rounding up negotiations to encourage one-stop shopping and have the Department of Revenue be responsible for fish bonding. You know, we found out somebody wants to go out and do commercial fishing, has to stop at least three, maybe four different departments. Just to get, they've got to post a bond with us for wages, and they have to go to Commerce and Economic Development, and they have to go to Fish and Game, and they have to go to Department of Revenue. And we went, this is nuts. You know, I have no territorial prerogative over fish bonding. Mm-hmm. And we're consolidating that over at the Department of Revenue, and if we have wage claims, we'll call the Commissioner of Revenue and say attach to bond. I think we're seeing a lot of that. You know, more of a make sense approach to how we can put things where they most likely make sense. We've had discussions with Commerce and Economic Development with regard to occupational licensing. There's another ridiculous scenario where occupational licensing is housed in the Commerce Department, yet we have enforcement responsibility. And the two departments, frankly, don't exchange or information particularly well. So I think we're seeing a lot of that. It has one of the advantages of having come down to Juneau with people that you had an established relationship with, and I'm very thankful for the people I serve with on the cabinet, because there wasn't a whole lot of sort of buying. You sort of hit the ground running in terms of a confidence level and a relationship that there were no territorial lines drawn. So in that regard, I think we will continue to go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, the Commissioner had mentioned your interest in support of safety in the workplace, occupational safety things, and then I believe started to indicate drug and alcohol testing. Could you elaborate on that? Would it be pre-employment? Would it be mandatory drug testing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruckman, I'll tell you what I know, and then I'll tell you what I don't know. What I know is that there's no question that alcohol and drug abuse in the workplace plays a significant role in the accident and injury fatality rate. What we don't know with regard to Alaska specifically, regrettably, our workers' compensation data, because of our system, it's very difficult to extract that information, but we're working on it. We know that there are companies that have made a significant improvement in their accident and injury rate when they have put in drug testing programs. I'm open to proposals. I tell you that I take issues of privacy very personally, and the idea of someone coming up to me and suggesting that they wanted to test me for abuse, I find very offensive. However, I think I might feel differently if I were had the responsibility of many lives in my hands. You know, airline pilots, people who are in medical professions who have responsibility for the life, health, and well-being of other people, or property for that matter. So I can't tell you definitively that I've made up my mind. I think that what we have seen is that those companies that have responsible drug testing programs have shown a tremendous success rate. How that, as a practical application, could be put into place in Alaska, I'm really not prepared to get specific on it, but I think there is a place for it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Any comments? Appreciate
it. I don't have another question. I just move that the committee forward its recommendation with individual actions.
We welcome to make the motion, but we've just been signing the sheets up to date on all the commissioners and passing them around. We haven't been making any motions.
Well, we haven't made a formal motion on it. This one's done, then?
Yeah.
This one's done?
I really, really appreciate your taking the time to join us today. On the other insurance question, Representative Taylor, if you could just talk to Mr. Walsh after the meeting, it allow us to get up to the next meeting. So.
Oh, you already did.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. He sent me a note. I just say hi, thank you very much.
Oh,
you're welcome. Yeah, I'm sorry
you stuck around.
That's fine.
Any other matters before the committee? Hearing none.